So I wanted to start by giving a better response to your question, Dylan's question on decoherence. So I didn't have time to look into the literature, but here's a very simple model that illustrates the point. Just this is the simplest model I can imagine. So let's just imagine we have a discrete position, so a particle has an x variable which is equal to, minus 2, minus 1, 0. Has some integer label. And so then the state corresponding to each position is like so. And then the environment is similar. We'll just label it by x. So these are the position states for the environment. So now let's imagine that the interaction is such that our system and our environment go to just to remain unchanged if x is not equal to x, and if x is equal to x, then we multiply by some overall phase factor. Now, so that's a simple, very simple example, and the interaction is local. So the Hamiltonian that's making this happen in the background has to be local as well. So now, look and see what happens if you start off with a state like this. Call it phi. Well, that will evolve to a new state. And you can do a calculation as to what this new phi state is. It's just whatever state you start with, I will assume that the original state of the environment. Is some linear superposition of possible position states. So the state afterwards will just be the same state except that c in the position of small x will be replaced by alpha times c. But everywhere else will remain the same. So that's equal to equal to that. So you can see now that for any position eigenstate, or for any position of the system, if the system is in a well-localized position, it will remain in a product state with the environment afterwards. So if you trace out the environment, if you ignore the environment, then you just end up with the same state. But what about if you have your original state is in a superposition? Of two different position states. Like this, for example. So then what's going to happen is your state will, and then your environment is in the same original state. What's going to happen now is your state will evolve to this. And you can see that these two things are different. That's it, sir. Less than one. Yeah. If you just look at the expressions, you can see that you'll get, if you take the overlap between two things like this, where x and y are different, then you'll get a number which the two states will not be parallel to one another, so therefore the overlap has to be less than one. Any questions on this so far? Is that clear? So you can see that for this state, some of the information has been imprinted in the environment, and it causes the thing to decohere. So if you trace out, if you ignore system, the environment, then you don't get x plus y. You don't have this original product state. You have some mixed state if you do the calculation. And you can make this model even more interesting. Okay, I forgot to start with the right presets. You can imagine that the environment is actually a wind. So, because one problem here is that although this overlap is less than one, it's not actually zero. So you haven't fully decohered your superposition. You still have some entanglement for the two positions. But what you could imagine is that the environment is a wind, so that you actually have lots of particles interacting. How to label this? X, I'm going to call it X, comma T. Well, this is a funny, okay. So you can imagine that each time T, the system that's labeled by X comma T is the one that's interacting with, so the environment that's labeled by X comma T is the one that's interacting with, yes, let's do that again. So the idea is you have your system here, somewhere along here, and there's a wind blowing past it. And at each time t, you have a different part of the environment interacting with your system, subject to the same interaction that I described before. So now what's going to happen is that as the wind blows past, the system will become increasingly entangled with its environment. And now you'll get, rather than having just an inner product like this, you'll end up with a tensor product of lots of environment states interacting. Is that clear? I'm not sure if I've explained that. Yep. Right. Yeah, so that's the point. The decoherence doesn't solve that problem. But what it does say, it does suggest a natural basis in which to describe, it does suggest a natural basis to imagine that you should have definite states with respect to. So this seems to suggest that X is a good basis, but superpositions involving X is not a good basis because they will decohere. so that the X will be a more robust basis under decoherence. That's really what's been suggested. Any more suggestions? Okay. Yep.
Am I right in thinking though that the reason that X is a good basis is just because at the beginning we stipulated that X phi is going to go to X phi X. I mean, it didn't have to be that. And the top line on the right, or
here, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So
exactly that. You know, whatever transformation is causing this change, you know, has X as a preferred basis.
Yeah.
But
Exactly. Yeah.
But we just kind of stipulated that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but this kind of thing is motivated by locality, that there's some preferred basis with respect to which you want your physics to be local. There's a question of which comes first, the horse or the carriage, I guess. Does the concept of position come first, and then you impose locality, and that becomes the preferred basis? Or is it just the case that there should be some preferred basis out there, and then that becomes the one you call position? You could maybe think in both
fair.
terms.
It doesn't like generalize well to like spinners or something, for example.
Maybe not, but I think as long as you've got enough, well, physics is generally is local. I mean, and it's often,
yeah,
and it's expressed probably in much more sophisticated ways than the way I've given you here. This is just a toy model. But generally, because of special relativity, physics has to be local. And so Hamiltonians have to have these kinds of properties. And so this sort of argument should always go through. I mean, of course, this is very much a toy example. Have to be seen in more generality to, you know, giving you Tom.
It's probably a silly question. Is there any way to go in reverse, like pull locality out of some assumptions on, you know, decoherence heading to?
Something I've thought about, and other people have thought about. You can try to imagine that you just sort of say you start off with Hilbert space, and then you assume that and some general, some arbitrary Hamiltonian, and you try to get sort of locality out of that and decoherence. So you can try to do that. I can give you some references to some papers where people have tried to do that. You can imagine going in reverse. I mean, I don't know that it's really been done successfully yet, but it's an idea one can explore.
Because I mean, I know there's like a big theme right now of looking at this stuff from the information theory perspective.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that would be a good information theoretic approach to.
Yeah, it strikes me as kind of like completely surprising that you could hope to get the company out of that.
You need sort of then a principle for constructing Hamiltonians that doesn't rely on locality because you're trying to get it out of it. And the only principle I can imagine is just randomness. Then you can ask, well, is randomness going to give you sort of in some appropriate basis locality? And I don't really know the answer to that, but it's an interesting area to think about. Yeah. Any more questions? Nope. Okay. Right. So I'll move on to the quantum Zeno effect, which I didn't get a chance to cover yesterday. And this goes back to Sudarshan and Misra. So it's a very, this is an interesting effect because it's very generic. Really, it's true for pretty much any quantum evolution you can imagine, pure state quantum evolution. So you start with a system. In some initial state, any initial state, we call it this. And now we evolve the state. So here I'm just using Schrodinger's equation to evolve the state. And if you expand this out just the first few terms, you're going to get, well, this term dominating. And then you've got another term which where the evolution can happen proportional to delta t. We're taking delta t to be small here. And then you'll get higher order terms. So just to look at this, we'll do the calculation in a minute. But if you look at this, you can see that, roughly speaking, the probability of it not being in state zero is proportional to delta t squared. And that's going to be the quantum Zeno effect. I'll explain why that's interesting. What I want here. Yes, that's what I want. Nope. okay. So we have this at the top. So now let's calculate the probability that the thing. So we want to calculate the probability that if we look to see if it's in the initial state, it's still in the initial state. Okay. So we perform a projective measurement onto this. So I'm going to call that this, and then the orthogonal projector is up to whatever the. So if you have some system. Which it has a bunch of eigenstates or a basis where zero is one of the basis elements, then this will be the orthogonal projector. So the probability that the thing decays, that it goes. That it's not in the zero state is that. And if you now substitute in the expression for phi at time delta t, then you'll get an expression like this, and I should tell you what k is equal to. Okay. So it's just some simple math to get to that.
Shouldn't one of those be a zero?
What are these ones? No, no, because you're projecting on to here, because you want to know what the chance is that it's not in the zero state.
Yeah.
So you want to take the overlap of your. I mean, this is the way to calculate the probability that it's not in the zero state. So you want not to have a zero there. Sure. This is just equal to. Yeah. This is the same thing as what's in there. Okay. The important point is that you get some constant that depends on the Hamiltonian times delta t squared. Yeah, you're not happy.
Yeah, I'm not, like, because if I substitute in psi of dt up there from that, then I get, I mean, n bar 0 is 0, and the other term is going to be n times h dt on h bar with the 0 came on the right.
Oh, sorry, did I not, what did I not do here?
And then you've got, like, n h on h bar n.
Yeah, I think what's it?
If one of those is 0, then I'm completely happy.
You would expect it to look like it's a transition.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I think what did I do here?
I think you just need to replace one of the ends with a 0. And then it, like, and that sounds a lot better.
Right.
Also, it means you don't have, like, problems where that h,
yeah,
that thing could blow up.
Let's just do the calculation. Okay. So that's what we want. Okay. And now, because delta t is small, you can approximate that by, you can approximate this thing. Now you substitute that into here, and what do you got?
First term cancels. The second term, it's all right. You seem to put in 0. I'm like, what's one of the bets?
Yeah, I think I, yeah, you need some 0 there. Okay. So this is wrong. You're correct. Let's just go for it. I think it should be what's happening here. Let's sort it out.
What are we missing? Like, doesn't if I maybe I'm missing something, but I thought that what you wrote, like, if you just, like Tom was saying, replace an n with a zero, then that's the, just the next line.
Yeah, sorry, I just want to make sure that this thing's proportional to delta t squared, and that's clearly got to be the case, but I'm, is there a simple cancellation? I'm not seeing it right now.
Well, when you put the one, if I hit the zero with the one, with the identity, it stays at zero.
Right, okay.
And then zero, n is orthogonal to n, so that will disappear.
Okay, good, good, okay.
And then the other term.
Right, thanks.
Yeah.
But
Nate's
great.
Pointed out that I think you only have one sum in there, you don't have a double sum.
One sum? Which one? Here?
So the point is that, like, you only have a one sum there.
Mm-hmm.
You can pull that out front, but then you won't, in your k, because you've got k squared, you've only got one sum in the entire thing, so you, I don't, how can you get like a, if you had like a sum of over n in k, then you'd have that sum squared in the final result.
Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, this is what I wrote down in my notes. I think I did the calculation at the time. Let's just look at this again. Yeah, okay, I think it's exactly what you said originally. Yeah. There should be a zero there. That's what you were saying, right?
That's
okay, okay, good. So you were, yeah.
Should probably be outside, so otherwise if I square that, I'm going to have two sums, but I'm only going to summing over one.
Oh, you think you want this modulus? No. Which square? The square would be here. Yeah.
Yeah. So k squared is equal to that square.
Yeah. Yeah.
That.
And that's good.
There's only one sum.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So possibly k squared is equal to the sum of like the expectation.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
The modulus of the whole thing squared. That sounds right.
Right. Okay. So well,
the key thing is
that it depends on delta t squared. Yeah. Yeah, and then there's some constant here. And for homework, you're going to sort that out for me. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Okay, and then so now if we have the probability, therefore, of getting the zero outcome is 1 minus k squared. Delta t squared. I'm just going to make a note to check this myself. Okay. Good. So now, so this leads to the quantum Zeno effect, which is that if you keep looking, then you can stop the system from decaying. So here's the idea. So what we do is we want to construct the probability that the system hasn't decayed if we look n times, where n is equal to, well, it's different n, where n is equal to like this. Okay, so we look every delta t, we do that for a time period of big T, so that's how many times we're looking at the system. So the probability it hasn't decayed is just the product of the probability it doesn't decay at each time so it's the product of that, because this is the number of times we look. And we can approximate that using a Taylor expansion. And now you can see that this delta t cancels with one of these delta t's. So the probability of decaying is 1 minus a term proportional to delta t. Now, if you keep looking, if you make delta t smaller and smaller, then this will go to 1. Which means that you can stop a system from decaying just by looking at it repeatedly. That's the quantum Zeno effect. It's good to compare it with what would happen classically. Okay, so what would happen classically? Well, so one example would be if you had exponential decay. So then the probability of decay, or of not decaying, after some short time is given exponentially. So you get a linear term, and that's just what happens generally in classical decay. The key thing is that when you look at a system in classical physics, you're not disturbing it in any way. And so it would be unreasonable for a system to freeze as a consequence of looking at it repeatedly. Whereas in quantum theory, when you look at the system, you're actually disturbing it, and therefore you can freeze it. Yep.
Can you derive quantum Zeno effect using like
right, so you're asking if you can, like, if you actually allow some disturbance, is that what you're thinking? And then could you get the Zeno effect? I mean, one way to get it is just where your measurement simply resets the thing back to the original state. And is that what you were going to say? Yeah. So then it would just never decay. I suppose the difference is that in the quantum case, you have to have the Zeno effect. In the classical case, you can imagine observing a system repeatedly and not having the Zeno effect.
So I mean, like, in the quantum case, you have either a definite it has decayed or it hasn't decayed.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of get that switch effect in classical mechanics with this kind of exponential decay. Like, you go through the procedure of being half decayed.
Right, it's an interesting...
Is that the root of this, or is it...
No, I don't think so. Well... You're thinking that classical systems are continuous, whereas...
Yeah.
I mean, you can imagine classical systems which are not, and it may even be that fundamentally, fundamentally, I suppose, physics is going to be quantum, but you can imagine that fundamentally physics was classical but discrete. So one can imagine classical discrete theories, and they would certainly have this this kind of property. So that's not the key difference. The key difference is this, I think. If you imagine that you have classical systems, and so let's imagine we have a three-level classical system. Okay, and then we have the probability for the system, the classical system being in each of the three levels. Then these probabilities have to add up to 1. So they have to lie on this surface here. And that's your state space, in a sense. So classical. It's a discrete, it's a state space, and it's a simplex, and it has a finite set of vertices, like so. Okay. If you look at the quantum case, take a qubit. Well, for a qubit, the density matrix is something like this. So this is a spin half system. But A is equal to some linear function of the PZs. I forget the. And the probabilities of getting spin up along the x direction and the y direction. So actually, I can't remember the exact expression for A, but it's got some complex coefficients in front of these things. So what that means is that. You can represent the same information that's in the density matrix as a list of four probabilities.
So what is the? So that means you've got a different, like you don't have, or you've got a different set of axes.
Well, this is just an example. So any classical system will have some, any discrete classical system will have some finite set of. Or some set of axes for each of this, and then you'll have a simplex, which is you'll just join these extremal points. So in the case, so what we can ask is what's the shape of the state space here, and okay, and what you get is. Okay, does anyone know what it would look like, the state space? What are the allowed values for this vector? If we assume that any intuition on this? Just curious.
Because you don't like.
Yeah, and that's right. This is I'm just going to constrain the fourth degree freedom to so that this is true. Yeah. So the answer is let's draw a unit cube inside this first octant here. I'm telling you what I'm doing because my drawing isn't necessarily going to be convincing. So that's a unit cube placed in that octant, and now draw a sphere. That touches all six sides. Okay, so that's a sphere touching all six sides of the unit cube. And now the pure states are the states on the surface of this sphere. The mixed states can be inside here, but the pure states are on the surface. So you can see that in the classical case, any dynamics kind of has to have some hopping probability to go from one vertex to another. That's sort of what's happening underneath. Whereas in the quantum case, you can evolve continuously along this surface. You can have a pure state which is here and another pure state which is here. So the pure states form a continuous set. Even though you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, the pure states form a continuous set. And so this, in a sense, is the reason that you can have something like the Zeno effect. In the classical case, you have to hop from vertex to vertex. And so you can't support this sort of continuous evolution on the pure states. Let's see, what time is it? Even in the continuous case, so let's imagine a continuous system. In the classical and the quantum case, and there's something interesting that happens. So in the classical case, if you want to get from here to here, it would seem there's really, you can either be here or here, or you can be at points in between. You have to kind of hop. In the quantum case, if I have this point and this point, then at least in the state space, if this is x, this is point x prime. In the state space, you have states like this. So at least in the state space, you can imagine disappearing, sort of slowly disappearing from this point and reappearing over here. So there exists a continuous set of states from here to here, which don't go through the points in between. So it's a very different kind of place, the quantum state space from the classical state space. Okay. Right. Okay, I've got 15 minutes left. So what I'll do in the remaining 15 minutes is I'll go through some more interferometry, but this case, this time for quantum optical interferometry. I'm just going to make a few points about quantum optical interferometry. I'm not going to talk about it very, very long. Last year, I spent more time talking about quantum optical interferometry. So if you're interested in it, you could watch the lecture on PERSA from last year. The reason I'm cutting this short is I want to make room, if possible, to talk about weak measurements and time-symmetric quantum theory, because there was a lot of interest in that. So I'm going to talk about single mode quantum optics. So, and also, we're going to assume that all the polarizations are the same. Okay, so we have yeah, so this is an interferometer. So we're imagining that we have a path or a mode with some photons traveling along it. We're only considering single mode, so they all have the same frequency. And we're also assuming that they all have the same polarization, so we don't have to worry about that degree of freedom. And the trick is to use creation and annihilation operators. So these are the creation operators, and these are the annihilation operators. And they have the property that... No, that's this. Sorry, yeah, sorry. These are the annihilation. These are the creation. They have the property that if you have a path which has n photons in the mode, and you act on it with an annihilation operator, then you get one less photon in the mode. And you also have this number appears in front. And creation operators do something similar. You can actually use these facts to prove this commutation relationship. So this means that you have n photons in a certain mode. You can go through and set up the various interferometer devices like we did before. Okay.
You know, if you want, you put that up and run on the back.
Which is, sorry, you mean use the very back?
Yeah, just push that one up and run on the board behind it.
Right. Yeah, I'm gonna. Okay, so let me just go through some of the devices. If you have a mirror, then I'm going to give the effect these devices have on the creation operators. And for the same reasons as last time, I'm just going to adopt some convention here with, I'm going to choose an I to be the phase picked up at a mirror. If you have a path length, then you have this, a phase shifter. Okay, so you get the idea. We're just doing the same thing we did before, but everywhere we're replacing, we're giving these relationships for between the creation operators. A beam splitter. Okay. So these are the kind of tools you need to sort of to study interferometers in the quantum optical setting. A lot of interesting stuff happens in that setting that you don't see in simple interferometry, as I described it last time. The way you go about this is you can write down a state. So here's a two-mode state. So there's a two-mode state. And now you can write that using these creation operators acting on the vacuum. So there's an example of a two-mode state.
So this is square root of m plus 1.
Yeah, the square root is over of m plus 1 factorial. Yeah. So clearly, if you act on the vacuum with a creation operator m times, then you're going to get an m here. And then you have to take care of the appropriate normalization state outside. Okay. You can hear it trying to move up. So an interesting thing would be to consider sending that state there through a beam splitter. So then you'd have to replace the operators, the creation operators. So yeah, the creation operators over there by the expressions in the formula. in the transformations up there. So you'd have this. I've also replaced these expressions as well. So I've got vacuum C and vacuum D. Now, strictly speaking, what I should have done from the beginning was just written the vacuum, which is the vacuum, the tensor product over the vacuum of all modes. So this will be the vacuum, the tensor product of the vacuum over all possible modes. So I really should have written that. But in each case, we're only interested in the modes that correspond to the creation operators that we have. So just to keep the calculation simple, we'll replace those modes by those vacuum modes by these vacuum modes. Yeah, I could have just put a single zero down there and then, yeah, sure. Whatever you want. One thing that's interesting to consider is whether this transformation is unitary. So it better be the case that for all the examples I gave you up there, the corresponding transformation, when you do anything like this, is a unitary transformation. I don't know a simple proof of that fact. I asked the question last year, and one of the Psi students came up with a proof that this transformation was unitary. It wasn't a simple proof, but it was a proof. So it'd be interesting if anyone has a simple proof of this fact.
Which transformation, like just the general beam splitter?
So I think it's not going to be a problem with the others, but suddenly the general beam splitter transformation, is that unitary? And you can even ask what's the, the point about that transformation is it's a unitary operator acting on the creation operators. So one could ask if a transformation of that, one could try to find the proof that a general unitary transformation on the creation operators corresponds to a unitary transformation when you write it out in full like this for any state, or for any application of this sort. Because usually in the quantum optics literature, they don't think in terms of the picture I gave you earlier of pure states evolving in some Hilbert space. They think in terms of creation operators and annihilation operators. And so I haven't seen that proof written out simply anywhere.
Well, it's the same thing as going from Schrodinger to Heisenberg.
Yeah, that might be true. So that may be the place to look for that proof. It's a simple proof there. Yeah. And when you look at this expression, you can see that what happens is that you get, you're going to create, coming out of the beam splitter will be a big superposition of having different numbers of photons in each of the modes. So if you have a big superposition, one will contain just a whole bunch of photons in, contain where all the photons are in one mode and so on. And what's interesting is actually you get kind of constraints on what can come out of the beam splitter that are a consequence of the commutation relations we have. Okay, I think I've run out of time. So I'll leave it there.